Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Trinity Talks. My name is Kyla, and I'm the Online Engagement Director here at Trinity.
Hi, my name is Justin Stratus. I also attend Trinity Streetsville. My day job is I am a professor of systematic theology at Wycliffe College and also the academic dean.
And my name is Rob, and I have the great pleasure of being the rector here at Trinity Streetsville.
Great. So you might know that in the month of November here at Trinity, we've been diving into the book of Habakkuk in a sermon series that's called The Struggle is Real. And for me, this has been a series that's been full of both challenge and encouragement as we've sort of looked at what does it mean to ask God some really hard questions? What does it mean to potentially have prayers go unanswered or to get really hard answers back from God that maybe we don't want? And so I'm really excited to be sitting down here with Rob and Justin, who have helped to preach our way through this series, and just ask, what are some questions? What are some things that thoughts that are coming out of this series? So I want to start with you, Rob. So you picked this series, you picked the book of Habakkuk, and just wondering why, what was it about Habakkuk that you wanted to sort of spend some time in?
So it's a good question. I think one thing for sure is that I know that we had just spent like 2 months prior to this, really focused heavily in the New Testament, right? Mm-hmm. We had been doing this series about Jesus and the Gospels and all the meals he ate with people. And so, so for several weeks, we were very much leaning into the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really good that we also spent some time in the Old Testament. You remember we did a series a little while ago called The Bible for Grownups, and we talked about how the Bible is this library, this big library of scripture, full of all these different books written at different times and different, locations and different genres, but somehow they tell this unified story that points us and leads us to Jesus. And so I think it's really easy to see how things point us and lead us to Jesus when you're reading the Gospels, but I think it's a good practice for us to really dive into Old Testament books to really relocate ourselves in different places and times, and yet still say, how is this pointing us to faith in Christ? So I'd say that was one reason. We just had to do more Old Testament stuff a bit. The other reason is, I think as a pastor, you get to know your people. Mm-hmm. And you start to realize, hey, you know what? People are actually struggling with stuff. There's, lots of times, people come to my office or, we visit them in their homes and we hear stories of struggle, whether it's, health struggles or financial struggles or, relationships. People are going through a lot. And so I think as a pastor of a church, it's important to be able to try to help people have the language to... Mm. To express how they're feeling to God and to other people and to, So I think it's just, there's a pastoral side to this maybe as well. We need to help people unpack the reality of their lives, which isn't always fun and rosy. And, sure. And then the third thing I'll just say is that's also the case. I think, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world, like right now. In fact, the week we kicked off this series, was the week of the American election took place, and there was a lot of, I think, anxiety in people about what this was going to mean. Were we heading into dark days again? Maybe, maybe not. There's wars going on. There's the conflict in the Middle East. There's conflict in Russia and Ukraine. And I think that, I think this book actually just gives us like a ton of resources to help unpack all that stuff too. So. So yeah, for all those reasons, I thought it was a good choice for where we were right now.
For sure. And I understand, Justin, that you're a fan of scripture in general, but Habakkuk in particular. And so just wondering, what is it about Habakkuk that you really appreciate?
First I just want to say it's really cool to hear like the story behind how certain series are picked and stuff, and that... It's kind of encouraging as someone who goes to this church to hear the thought that goes into it. And that's great. I love this book. I'm going to pronounce it weirdly and differently.
That's okay.
It actually is Habakkuk, I think, in Hebrew, but I say Habakkuk because I'm American. and Americans say things the way they want to. So yeah, about 20 years ago, I was in seminary, over 20 years ago, and I was in a class on the Minor Prophets, and I used to study at Denny's,
okay,
which is a 24-hour diner of impeccable quality. And I used to study there like until the middle of the night, like 3-4 in the morning. And I remember I had an assignment on Habakkuk, and I was there all night reading it, thinking about it. I was reading a commentary by a fellow called Donald Gowan, which is a very short little commentary. It's called The Triumph of Faith in Habakkuk. And I just did an all-nighter obsessing over this book and this commentary, and it was just blowing my mind. Mm. And I still to this day say that that's my favorite commentary, even though it's not really a proper academic commentary. It's just a little meditation kind of. But I love it, and it sort of kindled a real excitement about the Minor Prophets in particular. And I've just been reading Habakkuk and thinking about it ever since, particularly the third chapter, which Rob will preach on Sunday, about, you know, though the flower fades and the vine produces no fruit, yet I will praise the Lord. I mean, after the melee of the earlier chapters of the book, to get to that is such a powerful moment. And in general, I just love the Minor Prophets. I mean, yeah, they are an intense group of people.
Yep.
They don't pull any punches. They talk about life as it really is, and they do it all in the context of faith. And I think Habakkuk is just, it's one of my favorite examples of that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say something. I think it's really interesting. You said you pulled an all-nighter to work through and wrestle through this book. And I think that sometimes we are told that, oh, the Bible's easy. It's easy to read. It's easy to understand. You know, just pick it up and go. And but I think that the book of Habakkuk is a good example of, like, you kind of got to do your homework, right? You mm-hmm. you started off saying the name, right? Like, yeah, how do we even pronounce this, right? Like, it's not, some of these things are not self-evident, yeah. And this is a good challenge to people of faith, even here at Trinity, mm-hmm. to say, like, reading the Bible sometimes requires like all-nighters. It requires like wrestling matches with commentaries in your hand to figure out what was going on, what is going on, you know, and to, yeah, I just think that, and even last Sunday when you were preaching, Justin, I think you did a remarkable job of trying to take like what was going on in this, you know, ancient context, and then what, you know, you drew some amazing parallels to our own context, right? Like, that's hard work though, right?
Yeah, I mean, and the thing about Habakkuk, which is really interesting to me, is that it's also quite mysterious. There's one reference to the Babylonians or the Chaldeans, mm-hmm. as the text says. So it's not, and Habakkuk's not really mentioned anywhere else. You know, you get the book of Amos or Hosea, where they sort of appear elsewhere. There's a little bit of description of their call. Habakkuk is just there. Mm-hmm. Its historical setting is inferable, but it's not really front and center. So it's kind of talking about life. It's kind of talking about the cycles of reality that we experience as humans in this world, while also being slightly tethered to a concrete situation. So there's so much you can do with it. It's kind of inviting you to apply it to other situations and what we're going through,
yeah,
which is why it's kind of close to wisdom literature, like the Proverbs or the Psalms or Job. It's a prophecy, but it kind of straddles across, yeah, lots of different genres, and
sure,
it invites a lot of reflection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard some people call it like a mini book of Job, and it's always,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think the prophets in general, but I think the Minor Prophets in particular, are something that we don't necessarily spend a lot of time on. But similar to you, I found them to be like some of the books that like have bolstered my faith the most. Mm-hmm. They're the spaces where, yeah, just like people saying really direct things to God and to other people in a way that is super encouraging and challenging for me.
That's probably one of the reasons why we don't read a lot of minor prophets. Is like, we actually don't really like what they have to say to us. I mean,
yeah.
You know, sometimes it hurts.
And because they're smaller too, you get, you know, if you read one of the major prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, there's a lot of, you know, devastating stuff in it. Like Jeremiah is the weeping prophet.
Yeah.
But then you'll get these respites of two whole chapters of like, God, you're so great. You're going to rescue us. This is awesome. Yeah. We're going to ride on the wings of eagles. And the minor prophets is just, it's just mostly bad. But then you get these like sprinkles, like even in the passage I preached out on Sunday, it's like bad, 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 bad. But then the knowledge of the glory of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. And then it goes back into bad. So I feel like that kind of reflects what life is like, kind of, right? Mm-hmm. It's just all this struggle, and then this glimmer of light. And you have to hold on to that when you go back into the next section.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So the prophets in general, and Habakkuk in particular, have a lot of harsh and direct words for us. And in particular, God's initial response to Habakkuk's prayer seems kind of harsh, right? So, Rob, in your sermon, you sort of compared it to a teacher who uses a bully to punish this kid who's, like, causing a problem.
Right.
Right? And that seems really dramatic and, like, really unfair in some sense. Like, from a human perspective, you're like, well, why would God, you know, an all-loving, all-powerful God do that to people? So if someone's sort of wrestling through, okay, what does this mean, what would you sort of say there?
First of all, I'm not sure that analogy was a really helpful one or not. I'm not gonna stand by it. It was probably an oversimplification. I'm sure it was a gross oversimplification, but I think on the one hand, I think we would have to say that being on this side of history, we can actually see, looking back in some kind of retrospective way, that, oh, actually, God did, in fact, know what he was doing. They, of course, couldn't see that. And we, whatever we're going through, we cannot see that. But I think history bears out that there was a sovereign plan in place that God was working out. And so, I guess, like you just said, for the person who says this isn't fair, you know, how can I trust God? I would say that, well, actually, we do have the benefit of looking back and saying, okay, actually, God did work this out in a really good way that ultimately, as I said at the beginning, leads to the Messiah, you know, kind of arising at just the right time. So, but at the beginning of the second chapter of Habakkuk, I really latched on to this idea of perspective. And it begins with, you know, Habakkuk saying, I'm going to go up and I'm going to take my watch and I'm going to go climb up to the ramparts and I'm going to look and I'm going to see. And I just really loved that image of getting above what we can see, right? There's a human perspective, right? When we are going through struggles and difficulties, that's often all that we can see, right? What's coming right at us. But God has a different perspective, a higher perspective, right? My thoughts are not your thoughts. You know, God says, neither are my ways your ways. So I don't know how comforting this is to someone who's actually going through a struggle, but to say, oh, God sees it differently, or God's perspective is perhaps more than, again, I'm not sure that's a great pastoral answer to someone, but I do believe it. I do believe that it's true. And I mean, it's the height of arrogance for us to say, well, if I can't make any sense of this, then it makes no sense, right? I mean, we're the creature, right? He is the creator. I mean, I think even just a moment of like lucid thought would help us to think, okay, yeah, chances are I can't see everything and I don't know everything that's going on here. So I think there's that. And then I think the last thing I would say is that, you might say, God, how could you let this happen? How could you let this happen? But ultimately, we know that this very thing happened to Jesus himself, right? Like, God was not immune from injustice, right? God was not... Jesus himself was subject to the powers of a tyrant. And there's that wonderful... I think it's in John chapter 19, where Jesus is in front of Pilate, and he says... Pilate says, oh, don't you know that I have power to either free you or kill you? And Jesus says, you would have no power, actually. And this is shocking. Had it not been given to you by God himself. So So just contemplate this. God gives Pilate authority over Jesus and ultimately leads to his, you know, trial and crucifixion. So I guess what I'm saying, whatever the reason is that God lets us go through these things, it's not because he's detached and it's not because he doesn't care. Like that, the cross shows us that's not the reason, right? Jesus was right there in the trenches, experiencing this in the worst way. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Just some thoughts.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great point about Christ. I didn't think of that. The other thing I think about the themes in the prophets about God using Babylon or Assyria as God's instrument to sort of punish the Israelites or the Judeans is I think it's to point out that when calamity happens, you are not entering a God-free zone. Like God is not ceding his authority and sovereignty over the world in those moments, right? It's not like he's saying, well, you guys screwed up. I'm just going to hand you over to these people.
Right.
God is still overseeing things. And even though it's painful, you know that the God who is on your side is still arranging matters for your good, as it says in Romans. So even though it's a punishment and or sometimes it's just arbitrary natural evil, like a tornado hits your house, right? It seems chaotic. It seems insane. Mm. But the point of these passages is to say that God is still on God's throne.
Right.
You can still trust God because it's not like the ultimate power in the universe has been supplanted and now you need to bow the knee to Baal or Babylon or whatever. God is still God. And as insofar as God is still God, you can trust that things will be all right in the end.
Yeah. And related to that is for whatever reason, God seems to have decided that he is going to use human agents to work out his plan on earth for good or for bad, whether it's Adam and Eve, Genesis chapter one, and they screw up. Is that the end? Is God like done with? No, he, you know, Noah is going to, you know, kind of cleanse things. So he calls on another human being, another flawed human being to do something. And then he calls on Abraham, right? As another human being. Like it's like this seems to be like God's plan is that he is committed to using human beings to accomplish his work and to give authority to human beings to do that work, you know, whether it's to exercise dominion over, you know, creation or whether it's to be to help Israel become a kingdom of priests or whatever. Like, I'm giving you authority to do these things. The flip side of that coin, though, is definitely they're going to be held to account for their actions. It's not like it's a free pass, right? Yeah. So there is this tension. God says, yes, I'm using humans, flawed humans, to accomplish my plan. But on the other hand, they're going to totally make a mess of it. And you know, there's going to have to be some reckoning at some point about that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the point you were making, Justin, about like God still being on God's throne and still being present in that, it reminded me of, I think it's in Jeremiah, there's this section where Jeremiah is like sitting and he actually sees the presence of God, like, go with the people into Babylon, which to Jeremiah and to the Israelites, like, probably seemed like a really foreign, strange concept, right? Because God sits in the temple. Mm-hmm. And so when the temple is destroyed, obviously God is gone, right? But actually the presence of the Lord follows them into their struggle.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Mm. So, Justin, last week you were talking about Habakkuk's conversation with God, where Habakkuk sort of asked this question, okay, how long are they going to get away with it? And in response, you said that God's question is perhaps, well, do you have the faith to wait for it? And that was God's question to Habakkuk. I think it's probably also God's question to us as we wait out the problem of evil. And so my question then is, so what does that look like to wait? Is there something that we're supposed to be doing in this time, or are we just sitting back and waiting?
Yes. Okay. I think I see where you're going with this. I don't think waiting is total quietism.
Sure.
In fact, I think whoever it was did the intercessions on Sunday, prayed something really nice about, you know, help us to be active waiters and to stand against evil when it's required and so forth. The nice thing about Christian responses to evil is that we are to respond to it, but because God is sovereign over the whole, we don't bear the weight of that drive towards fixing problems on our own.
Right.
So it's not like we have to be busy and active and anxious or the world will fall apart.
Right.
No, we stand up against injustice in the knowledge that we are participating in a kingdom which God has promised will actually come to reality eventually. So it's kind of like an unhurried, restful activity that Christians do. Mm. I think it's an activity born out of love for one's neighbor and for the world, and not born out of fear and anxiety that it all rests on our shoulders. So all that to say is waiting doesn't mean you just sit back, you know, and it's kind of like those folks that really got into prophecy in like the 19th century. And the whole point of studying prophecy and what's going to happen in the future was to basically, when it happens, point at the world and be like, aha, we told you so. See, Christians don't just sit there and say, I told you so, when things unfold as we expect. We get involved, right? We get in the muck, but we don't do it in a worried way. But it also is hard.
Of course,
right? Yeah. That's what faith is. Faith is acting on the basis of what God promises rather than what our eyes can see. And when the world is swirling in chaos around you, that's a really difficult thing to do. I had a teacher one time in seminary who said, I think he was talking about Abraham's faith. Mm. And he said, what is faith? Well, if you look at Abraham's life, it just seems to be kind of good old-fashioned Christian guts. Like, it's just holding on for dear life, even though it seems ridiculous and things are kind of crumbling around you. And the promise God gave is just so, like, ridiculously huge. Like, I'm going to give you bajillions of descendants and the whole world's going to be blessed through. It just, you can't wrap your mind around it.
Yeah.
To believe that, you just got to hold on for dear life.
Yeah.
And no matter what life throws at you, that's so it's not passive waiting. It's waiting with resolve, with grit. Mm. That's what faith is.
Yeah. I think too that although it's unpleasant and we don't want to hear this, there are some things that God does in our life that can only happen in times of waiting. Like, you know, the Apostle Paul, I think, would say that persevering through difficulty and calamity is how, you know, it leads to patience, and patience leads to character, and character leads to ultimately to hope, right? And I think, you know, there's so many saints walking the earth today that would say, like, yeah, I went through a very, very dark time. Mm-hmm. And looking back, it was also the time of my life where I grew the most. And again, nobody really wants to hear that in the midst of the dark time. Well, I'd rather God grow me during times of prosperity, and I'd rather God, you know, really transform my heart and my thinking during times of plenty. But that's just not how it works. And so there is, I think, in times of waiting, an invitation, a hard invitation, but an invitation to submit to what's happening to you in a way to say, okay, God, I don't get it, but you're doing something here, and I don't want to miss out on the person you're trying to form me into during this time. Now, so I think that's also an important aspect of waiting. And then I want to add this, like Tim Keller is the late, great Tim Keller. He, one of the things he said that is only possible to figure out in the time of waiting is to really gauge the reason why you got into this relationship with God in the first place, right? This is like the classic, you know, Job's situation, right? Like, Satan says to God, oh, the only reason he loves you is because you're good to him,
yeah.
Right? You take away all that stuff, he's not going to love you or serve you or worship you, right? And so let's see what happens, right? Yeah. Let's see if Job's faith actually was just faith and, you know, he just loved the stuff God gave him, or did he actually have faith in God and actually love God for who God was? But you cannot figure that out when everything is good. I don't think there. It's even possible. It's only when things get stripped away from you that you're actually left with the question, okay, am I still in this because of who God says God is? Or was it all about the good times and the good stuff?
Sure.
I think that only happens in waiting. Yeah.
Can I say one thing? I just want to, when we talk about things like suffering and God's ability to use it and the dark times being in retrospect, the periods in our lives when we grew the most, I also want to make sure we understand that evil and suffering is not good in itself. What God does with these dark times is he redeems them, right?
Yeah.
There's that verse, I think it's in Joel, where he's like, when I'm going to replace the crops that the locust destroyed.
Right.
It's not like you'll look back and realize, actually, it was good when I had 10 years of crippling depression.
Right.
No, God's going to redeem that time. Right. In your life. If without God, these things wouldn't be good.
Right.
Right. Because God can take these ashes and turn them into something beautiful. So if you're, you know, if you're struggling in a really bad time, you shouldn't be thinking, well, it's horrible that people are treating me poorly or I'm being bullied or treated like a doormat, but I'm just going to take it because eventually it's going to be revealed to be good. Mm. No, what's getting you through is you're trusting that God will redeem this one day. He will make something good out of something bad.
Right.
Mm. But that doesn't make the bad good.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Justin, when you, that's a really good point. And I wonder, is this also true on a larger scale? I'm thinking of like C.S. Lewis, who said, you know, pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world or something like that. Like, what do you take from that?
Again, I think I would take it in terms of redemption. Right. I don't think God is your drill sergeant being like, I'm going to make this a horrific month of basic training so that you come out a better soldier. Mm-hmm. I think it's God saying that we live in a fallen world. Right. And God is going to have to govern this world that's fallen, not because of God. Right. But because of sin. He's going to govern it in a way that he can turn it good. Mm. Right. So he can use something that is bad, i.e. pain.
Yeah.
Something that's irredeemably bad. Right. God is going to destroy pain. If you look at the visions in Revelation and Isaiah 65, like at the end of all things, God's going to be like, I don't want any more tears.
Right.
Right. But God is so sovereign and so loving and powerful and wise that God can even work through the ministrations of a fallen world to do things like speak to us clearly, in Lewis's terms, right?
Right.
That's the power of God, I think. Like, even a fallen world can't inhibit God's ability to get to us. In fact, God can even use a fallen world to get to us.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's definitely a tension. Because, I do think deep down that if we never experienced struggle, then I don't know that we would grow in our faith, cling to God all the more, develop that character. Like, so I hear what you're saying. If evil is an intruder in this in this world, this is not how it's supposed to be. But then if it weren't here, I just wonder, what would the human being, you know, what would I be like you know, what would you be like, Kyla, if you hadn't had to go through, would you be the same person? Would you be as strong a person or...
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think, I wonder if even like our framing of that question and our way of thinking about that question is itself like somehow a product of the fall. There was an original goodness, that there was, like, I think Adam and Eve pre-fall had a relationship with God and we're in some way probably growing in that relationship with God.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to say that it's
that sanctification couldn't have taken place through just fellowship,
some other means, right? Yeah. Like I don't know.
I mean, this is a fun podcast, so I don't get into too much academic theology, but But there are theologians who talk about God creating human beings in a state of imperfection, right? So that the point of life is to drive us forwards towards a more perfection, not in the sense of like really pristine, but in the sense of fulfilling our destinies, the reason for which God created us. So historically, there was a church father by the name of Irenaeus who argued this in one of his books. God creates us imperfect, and then he's got to sort of give us challenges and tasks, and that ends up perfecting us.
Right.
I guess I would want to distinguish between struggle, things that require effort and problem solving and challenge, from evil, because evil, the goal of evil is to destroy us, right? The goal of Satan and his demons is to destroy us, not to build us up. Again, I think in the state of the after the fall, God can even use the intentions of evil to destroy us for good.
Right.
That's the power of God. But I wouldn't want to say that, let's say, I don't know, something really horrific happens to you. You don't want to say like, yeah, God sent that into you because he knew you needed to learn patience.
Right.
But God can still use that thing to give you patience.
Right.
Despite that thing's intention to destroy you. Which is why God is so cool.
Yeah.
Because he can do stuff like that. But yeah, if you're interested in, you know, soul-building theodicy, check out John Hick's 1966 book, Evil and the God of Love. But
anyway, okay, yeah. Great. So in this process of walking through suffering and waiting and knowing that God is going to use that, I think some folks can find encouragement in that. Some folks, like you said, it's really hard. They don't want to hear that. So for people of faith, how do we walk through that faithfully? How do we walk through that without developing this sense of resentment towards God that, God, why aren't you here sooner? Or God, why did you allow this thing at all?
But isn't that, in a sense, what Habakkuk's trying to teach us, that it's okay to be resentful toward God? Like, it's okay to say, this isn't fair, right? You're being a bully, right? You're not listening. I don't want to talk to you right now, all right? Like, I think God would rather have us be resentful toward him than to walk away from him altogether. There's something, I think, that's okay about it, actually. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I mean, the Psalms are a great example, right? There's Psalms, the famous imprecatory Psalms, Psalm 88, which ends with no happy note. It's just like, the darkness is my only friend, the end, right? It's sort of like, the ball's in your court, God.
Yeah.
I've given you my complaint.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Yeah. There is, I think, something interesting about the way people complain in the Bible, because their complaints and resentments are always kind of based on their faith in God. That's the nature of the complaint. How long? Right. The implication is, you will save us. You're just not doing it when we want you to. Look at the way Moses complains to God at Mount Sinai when the people make this golden calf, while Moses is up there hanging out with the Lord, comes down, sees the calf. He's super angry. Smashes the plates, goes back up to God, and God's like, you know what? I'm done with these people. I'm going to destroy them. And then Moses has to argue. Here is why what you're suggesting, God, is bad.
Yeah.
Right? And the grounds for Moses' complaint is, if you do this, the world will watch as you renege on your covenant with us that you made. And they will laugh at us, and they will laugh at you.
Yeah.
So that's a harsh thing. Like, I don't usually pray that way. Like, God, let me give you three reasons why you should do this thing that I want. But the grounds for his argument with God is the covenant itself, is the promises of God. You can't do this because of what you said, God. So it's this weird kind of bold complaint in your face with God, telling him you're mad, but simultaneously believing God's promise.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's an interesting space that God's people live in. What grounds would another person outside the covenant have for complaining about what God does? They kind of can't. But God's people can, and according to Scripture, are encouraged to complain to God on the basis of God's promises.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Habakkuk is built around three complaints, right? And that second one, you know, Lord, are you not from everlasting? I think that I remember reading that the "are you not" phrase, it just most times it appears in the Bible, it's a resentful kind of accusatory. It's not just, oh, I have a real question. Are you from everlasting? No, it's like, I thought you were from everlasting. I'm I just love that.
So like, Habakkuk is kind of like a caddy. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was under the impression that you were the everlasting God, but obviously I'm wrong.
Right. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about sort of some of these concepts and things in a sort of abstract way. So I want just for a moment to take it back, make it a little more personal, and think, what are you taking away from this series? How has these 4 weeks impacted your own life and faith?
Well, I think it's kind of what Rob alluded to earlier. It's a very tumultuous time in the world.
Yeah.
There's things that are going on that greatly distress me, that's impacted my family, my family's mental health, my extended family. And it's very tempting to throw in the towel.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wearing a Yankees hat, right? The Yankees lost the World Series, my beloved Yankees. And every time that happens, you want to be like, I'm done. I'm done with this team, right? I think Habakkuk's, in a way, being like, keep supporting the Yankees, right? it's all these things are going on, and you just want to give up, right? And I'm reminded that, you know, and it's, especially these days, it's just wave after wave of bad news, and you think you're tempted to say God's not big enough to handle all of this, or he's unconcerned with this world, or he's obviously left it behind. And Habakkuk's like, nope, keep going, yet I will praise him. And that's what I've been thinking about a lot over the past month or two.
Yeah, I think heading into this, for the first time in my life, I think I had gotten sucked into the social media newsreels on X, especially. I'll confess.
You can call it Twitter.
Yeah, I'll just call it Twitter still. But I have to admit, every day I was like, leading up again to the American election, I was giving you that example. This was not normal for me. I normally didn't follow that stuff. I really didn't really care that much about it. But for some reason, I was getting like just so like caught up in it and feeling like invested in it and just like so anxious to see what the outcome was going to be. And I honestly believe that because we studied this right when, you know, the election happened, and then there was all these uproars, this side, whatever, it really did enable me to step back a bit. I really gained a different perspective on this. I began to look at all this as these players that are, you know, they're clearly people with power, and there's good and there's evil in the world, but somehow God can do something here. Maybe God is doing something here. Who am I to say God's not doing something here? It doesn't necessarily change my political leanings one way or the other, but there was a sense of like, I can release that. I would never say we distance ourselves from the need to like give a voice to the voiceless or to call out evil and oppression and like to defend the oppressed and all. Like, I'm not saying like, oh, I'll just wash my hands of all that and just let that just happen as it happens. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. But there was this anxiety that had built up in me about things.
Yeah.
And I can honestly say that I don't feel that nearly to the degree that I did before we kind of went through this together.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the things this series has done is just give me space and permission to like process the things with God and with other people. Mm-hmm. And recognize that like I'm not alone in that, both like not alone in the present moment, but also not alone like in the history of the faith, right? That there have been people from thousands of years ago who were praying these same prayers about different circumstances, but the same prayers that said, yeah, God, this isn't okay. And, and you don't need to walk away from that feeling like things have been resolved. You can just sort of like leave it in God's hands.
Yeah. Man, I really feel like sometimes we missell Christianity as the thing that's going to fix stuff or resolve everything.
Yeah.
It will eventually. But as Habakkuk 3 says, in the meantime, you can't withhold your praise until you see that materialize. I don't know. I feel like when we evangelize people, we're like, if you become a Christian, all your problems go away.
Right.
Your addictions will stop instantly. Like, and no, what we're saying is you have to, what you're going to have is a promise that you can hold on to now.
Right.
Where you didn't have that before. And now your struggles with sin and suffering and all of the rest take on a new meaning.
Yeah.
That they didn't have. It's not just despair. It's struggling to the end of your resurrection and your redemption. Mm-hmm. And that's powerful, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. For sure. Good. Well, thank you very much, folks. This has been a really deep conversation and lots to think about and unpack, but I think it's also been a really helpful conversation, definitely for me and hopefully for folks who are listening as well. So thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Trinity Talks, and we'll see you again next week.